The major struggles in the civil rights movement took place in the years before the internet and before TV news really became a huge deal. So still pictures communicated many of the key moments. And one of the people who took some of the iconic photos of the civil rights movement also turned out years later to have been conveying information from the movement to the FBI, which worked actively to discredit the movement and civil rights leaders. Ernest Withers was the name of the photographer. He's the focus of the new book, A Spy in Canaan, How the FBI Used a Famous Photographer to Infiltrate the Civil Rights Movement. It's the work of Mark Parisquilla, who works for the Commercial Appeal, the daily paper in Memphis. He's been there for nearly three decades now. Mark's work in both feature writing and investigative reporting has received a number of awards. Mark Parisquilla, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
This has not been a story that revealed itself overnight. You've been working on this since, what, 1995?
Well, I mean, it does sound like a long, long period of time. Actually, I first got a tip from an FBI agent in 1997 who he told me that, confidentially, that Ernest had been a longtime informant for the FBI. He refused to go on the record, and I just let it lie for years. And it wasn't until after Ernest Withers died in 2007, I filed a Freedom of Information Act request and was able to piece some things together because they left his code number, his FBI informant number, in it was supposed to be redacted, but they left it in a document. And it just was a long series at that point of kind of detective work, putting it together, tracing that number through other reports. The number is a unique identifier and was able to flag a number of things that Withers had done for the FBI. We eventually, you know, wrote up several stories, got the handwritten notes of the agent who ran them, sued the FBI. The FBI denied everything. And it was a long, dragged out Freedom of Information lawsuit that we eventually won through a mediated settlement and gets a whole motherload of records that spelled out what Ernest was doing for the FBI over the course of 18 years.
Are we talking a room full of boxes of records or something?
Well, no. They were released in PDFs now. I don't know. I printed out a lot of them, but, you know, we're talking about hundreds of pages, thousands of pages. I created a spreadsheet and inventorying the work that he was doing, and I counted more than 1,400 unique photos and unique reports, and those reports oftentimes would be monthly or weekly, periodically debriefings, and there would be numbers. He would provide the FBI in a single report information on sometimes scores of people who were active in the movement here.
So Ernest Withers was known for much more than photography. I mean, how big a deal was he in Memphis?
Oh, he was huge. Still is huge. I mean, he is a hero here. He is a legitimate civil rights hero. I mean, Ernest took some of the pivotal pictures of the movement, and some of them, I mean, even though the name Ernest Withers is not, you know, a household name, his pictures, if, you know, you're a student of the movement, you'll recognize them. Like, for example, this picture of Dr. King on one of the first integrated buses in Montgomery in 1956. There's a very haunting picture of Emmett Till's great uncle, Moses Wright, on the witness stand, standing up and pointing this accusing finger at the killers. Ernest took that. Ernest was at the integration of the Little Rock Central High, the integration of Ole Miss, covered the funeral of Medgar Evers, the sanitation strike here in Memphis, just on and on and on. All these, he was a freelance newsman. He had a studio on Beale Street. And he worked for the Chicago Defender, their satellite operation in Memphis called the Tri-State Defender. And he was well-known, well-liked, had great access. Some people have referred to him back as Google of Memphis back in the day because he knew everybody. He was everywhere. And so, you know, he was big back then. He's big now. He's got a blues note on Beale Street, which is the local equivalent of the Hollywood Star. He's got a building named after him. His house was recently put on the National Registry of Historic Places, and he has a museum down on Beale Street too. So he's big. He's legitimately a true civil rights hero. His pictures, you know, propelled the movement. It was just that there was this other side that no one really knew about that until I started digging around and you know, unearthed it.
How close was Ernest Withers to, I mean, because you begin the book just a few hours before Martin Luther King Jr.'s murder in Memphis. How close was Withers to him?
To Dr. King?
Yeah.
Well, King knew him, and his King's circle, the SCLC staff knew Ernest pretty well and liked him very much. Now, the thing is, I think some people have played up the connection between Dr. King and Ernest, because the truth of the matter is, Dr. King was based out of Atlanta, and he seldom came to Memphis. He came here in the late 50s. He was here in 1966 after James Meredith was shot, and led the march through Mississippi called the March Against Fear, that was based out of Memphis. And then he came here several times during the 1968 sanitation strike. And so even though the FBI in that period nationally was just all over King, Hoover perceived him as an enemy of the state and a dangerous individual, the security file on Dr. King in Memphis out of the Memphis field office is rather thin, because simply for the fact that he wasn't here much. But nonetheless, when he was, Ernest did inform on him. They all knew him. You know, they knew his work. They knew who he was. They liked him. They'd get together and laugh and whatnot. He did help the FBI quite extensively investigating Dr. King and the SCLC from a period of about 2 weeks before Dr. King died here in Memphis, and on for another year and a half to 2 years as the SCLC continued to come into Memphis for various events, movements, organizing. Ernest funneled a lot of reports and pictures back to the FBI about who they were meeting with, what they were doing, how their plans were working out, photographs, this sort of thing.
I want to take a little personal aside here, Mark, because you write in the book about the cities of Memphis's great current of corruption, almost wistfully. I mean, when you were moving there, what appealed to you about Memphis as a new home?
Well, you know, I grew up in Wisconsin and went to school at the University of Minnesota. And so I guess I came from an environment there that was completely different from the South. And, you know, my first job in Memphis, you know, the paper was much bigger, had a much wider reach back in those days. And I'm talking going all the way back to 1989. So I'm going to reveal how old I'm getting here. But we had a bureau deep in the Delta, you know, which is the Deep South down there in Greenville, Mississippi. And so, I mean, it was just, everything was new to me, you know, seeing all the poverty, the cotton fields, you know, the way of life. It was fascinating to me. And, Memphis, as I got settled in here, has a notorious history of corruption. It's kind of settled down a bit now. The FBI did a big bribery sting a little bit more than 10 years ago, and it seems to have kind of cleaned up the town, although the corruption runs in cycles. You know, every 10, 15, 20 years, they seem to have these big outbursts of it. And but, you know, for years, that's what I was doing. I was doing a lot of shoe leather reporting, investigating politicians, and, you know, a lot of them who went to jail. So I don't know. It's just been kind of a very fascinating experience for me here. I'm 29 years into it and into my 30th year here in Memphis.
Within that context, is it a little easier to understand how somebody like Ernest Withers could be essentially playing two sides of the street at the same time?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the thing is, Ernest was, in addition to being an informant in one period of his life, he was also a police officer for the city of Memphis and later a state policeman for the State Alcoholic Beverage Commission, and got caught up in corruption in both of those stints as policemen. And, you know, they always say you got to walk a mile in someone else's shoes to understand them. And, you know, Memphis is a city of great poverty. There's numbers of people who just don't have the opportunities, and, you know, that other people have. And this for years fed into this corruption here. That we called it a culture of corruption, but I mean, there were a lot of individuals who, when they got into public office, they were looking for a source of income, you know, money in that. And so this culture went on for years, and Ernest got caught up in it too.
So how did Ernest get onto the road? I mean, he had a photography studio, shot weddings, things like that. How did he end up going on the road in search of civil rights pictures? And was he one of few, or was he the only African-American photographer in the group?
No, he wasn't the only, but his timing was impeccable, I got to say. And it wasn't necessarily on his own accord, but, you know, he was fired from the police department in 1951, and he really focused on his photography then. I mean, he had a studio while he was a police officer, but he continued that studio. And kind of as he, when in 1951, the Chicago Defender opened up the Tri-State Defender, and so that he began freelancing with them then. And then, of course, a couple years down the road, the civil rights movement starts to blossom. And a lot of it's happening, you know, just within short striking range of Memphis. You know, these all the stuff down in Mississippi with Emmett Till. You know, they sent Ernest down. He was a young freelance photographer as part of a crack team. You know, he was down there with Simeon Booker and L. Alex Wilson and some of the giants in the news industry for writers and for African American newspapers. And he was getting he started getting really good assignments. And when he got after that, they sent him down to help cover the Montgomery bus boycott and, you know, various school integration crises and just on and on and on. It's just he really was at the right place at the right time.
Did he make any kind of money selling the pictures?
See, now this is the thing. If you read interviews from Ernest, that's a common theme. He complained about how little they paid. And this is the thing that I believe is a motivating factor for Ernest in cooperating with the FBI, was that he had 8 children to feed. He had to hustle for a living, and he was very good at it. I mean, he would cover Negro League baseball games and the blues scene on Beale Street, and would find all manner of ways to sell pictures to fans and individuals and portraits. And the news business was another source of revenue for him. And then, of course, it started out pictures that he could sell to the FBI. And so he grew up kind of middle class, but he was never able to break out of that, even though he took all these wonderful pictures. He pretty much was, you know, struggling all his life. He bought a house in Memphis in 1954 and never moved from it. It's just a humble, modest place. So money was always an issue for him. You know, he had a big family to feed, and he was definitely a family man who was going to take care of his wife and kids.
Mark Paraskia is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He has been investigating for a long time now the work of the African-American photographer Ernest Withers, who was taking some of the key photographs of the civil rights movement and at the same time conveying information to the FBI and photographs as well. The book is called A Spy in Canaan, How the FBI Used a Famous Photographer to Infiltrate the Civil Rights Movement. Through the photographs that Ernest gave to the FBI, it was certainly easier for the FBI to know who they were dealing with. But, but from all the research, what could you tell about any effect Ernest's photographs and the information he provided might have had in anybody getting arrested or operations getting diverted or things getting changed in the civil rights movement because of him?
Well, I mean, that's kind of like the $64,000 question as far as what impact the FBI had in the movement as a whole, because no doubt they were trying to derail, you know, the movement, segments of it, individuals, and, you know, sometimes whether they really derailed the movement as a whole is it, you know, a tough question. I don't know that there's a lot of evidence for that, but certainly numbers of individuals were hurt by these operations. And, you know, Ernest would do all kind of manner of things for them. Like, you know, they wanted identification photos, and he had all this access he could tell. You know, they were indexing the movement, and they wanted to know who was connected to who, you know, where they lived, who their blood relatives were, what their occupations were. And he could deliver all that. And, of course, the dossier always, you know, begins with an identification photo. And so he would hand over letters that people in the movement wrote him. He would pass on tag numbers, phone numbers. These phone numbers, when Ernest would give them phone numbers, Bill Lawrence would take them and do warrantless searches of individuals' toll charges. He had a source in the phone company, and they wanted to figure out who, you know, a target, who they were talking to, you know, who their associates were. There was a young man this went on for years, but in 1971, 72 thereabouts, the Communist Party had kind of revived in Memphis. There were these young students who had formed something called the Young Workers Liberation League, which was a youth organization of the Communist Party. And the FBI was all over that. And Ernest was helping them, you know, investigate them. And at one point, Ernest, you know, went to one of these guys' employer, and somehow or another was able to get information out of his employee file, like his home address and his social security number, which he accurately reported to the FBI. And then shortly after that, couple agents show up, and, you know, they're in the office and they're saying, you know, this guy, this employee who was nothing more than a truck driver, he's a communist. And they were trying to get him fired. There were, you know, lots of incidents like that. There were a couple of employees of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission in the late 60s who were deemed to be too close to the Black Power movement. And they were investigated. Their information was turned over to their supervisors. And some of the information included things like, you know, Ernest telling them that they were at certain meetings where Black Power-oriented meetings or social gatherings. And in one incident, Ernest reported to Lawrence that he saw Bobby Doctor, who was one of these field reps at the Civil Rights Commission who was under investigation, saw him at a march, and he was holding hands with a woman. And the FBI wanted that photo, and he gave it to him. And the way Lawrence wrote the report, he said that Bobby Doctor was holding hands with a woman. Bobby Doctor's married. The woman's married, but they ain't married to each other. And clearly they were working an angle there. By Bobby's account, the FBI delivered a thick file on his activities to his employers, and he nearly lost his job. And his coworker there, Rosetta Miller, very similar thing happened. I mean, she was called in too. So, I mean, there was definite jeopardy. And a lot of these things, we're never going to know, you know, how people were hurt, because the FBI in Memphis, like in a lot of cities, helped the local police department, the Memphis Police Department, set up its own intelligence operation. They, you know, often called these things red squads because they were often investigating communists or subversives, people they believed were dangerous. And there was a big information sharing going back and forth. And so a lot of the information that the FBI would pick up, they would send over to MPD, and MPD would harass the heck out of a lot of these activists. I mean, and try to ding them in a lot of minor ways, like catch them when they didn't, you know, they didn't have their cars registered, or but in, you know, drug use type things too. And so there were just numbers of ways that they could, and they were constantly knocking on doors too when they got information on individuals, and that's a pretty scary thing. And you know, in the buckle of the Bible belt, where you've got two FBI agents knocking on doors and talking about individuals that they're disloyal. And you know, you got to remember the Cold War. I mean, this is still a huge deal. So there were numbers of ways that they did hurt people through these operations.
The book is called A Spy in Canaan, How the FBI Used a Famous Photographer to Infiltrate the Civil Rights Movement. The photographer Ernest Withers, the author Mark Paraskia, our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. So, you know, as revered a figure as Ernest Withers still is in Memphis, I mean, I can imagine, have you had to change your phone number a few times since you first broke the story?
No, but, you know, this has... There, you know, over time, and this has been like, 7-8 years since I first broke the story, and you know, this was quite a bit of reporting that I did as we were litigating when we were fighting the FBI. I mean, there's been pushback. You know, he is a revered figure. There's no question about it. And people oftentimes don't want their heroes soiled. You know, my position is, and has been, you know, that I'm not trying to erode Ernest Withers' legacy. You know, I'm just trying to tell the full picture. It's a very instructive history, this hidden history there of this other side of what he was doing. And, you know, it was a very insidious period. You know, a lot of, you know, very corrosive to democracy. A lot of, you know, people who had unpopular political views were silenced. They were harassed. They kept dossiers on them with all their activities. So, you know, it's an important lesson, I think, for this city and for the country as a whole to know, you know, what your government is up to and how they're using individuals to do that.
You remind me of a song by the Chad Mitchell Trio that was popular in my house when I was a kid. It was about the John Birch Society, but there was the refrain I remember best is, "If mommy is a commie, then you got to turn her in." You know, so this is how people felt about how they had to protect the country.
Absolutely.
But there was nothing in Ernest Withers' own papers, or did he keep diaries or anything that indicated what was his thinking?
I'm not aware of it. Of course, now he had a big office down on Beale Street to the very end when he died in 2007. It was cluttered with all kinds of you know, paperwork, you know, not only photographic prints and negatives, but all sorts of paperwork. So, I mean, who knows? I mean, he had a lot of stuff in there. So, and of course, they've been curating a lot of that since then, and I'm not privy to it. I mean, they haven't shared anything with me, but it's possible. He did make one oblique comment that I know of to a historian here, and it showed up in one of Ernest's picture books, in a, like a 42-page essay about Ernest's work for the covering the civil rights movement. There was a like 6-sentence paragraph that mentioned Bill Lawrence. And it's very interesting. This is the only indication that I have that Ernest ever spoke about Bill Lawrence. And he said that Ernest said that that he was motivated by, he didn't like certain confrontationalists like the Reverend James Lawson, who was a big movement icon. I mean, he was like the father of the sit-in movement and big in the Freedom Rider movement and very close to Dr. King. But this marching in the streets, this direct action, getting in your face, evidently was a factor in that. But, man, the reference there is very oblique. It's not clear what he's saying, and it wasn't explored in any way. It's just a couple of, you know, a few sentences on a page, and you're left to scratch your head and going, wow, somebody really missed an opportunity there to figure out, you know, what was going on.